This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Here are reports on a new diversity hiring program in Bloomington. The NAACP's Quincy Cummings says it came about following a Freedom of Information Act request.
What we did not see was enough minority and female representation in professional, technical, and leadership positions.
Hear how the city may hire staff to reflect the rest of the city, GLT's Ryan Denham reports. A youth soccer league is launching a fundraising campaign for new fields. GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds talks with an Illinois Fire Juniors board member about what it could take to move from community fields. And hear how a $1 million expansion at Habitat for Humanity's Restore could put more people in affordable housing. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's Thursday, May 24th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. We've seen again and again what can happen when a community's police force doesn't match the diversity of its citizens. Many cities are trying to hire more officers of color. But what about a city's accountants, its engineers, and other top administrators? Sensing a lack of diversity in certain areas, the city of Bloomington recently launched a new diversity enhancement group initiative. GLT's Ryan Denham spoke with Bloomington Talent Acquisition and Development Manager Michael Hurt about why the city partnered with the Bloomington Normal NAACP on the project.
We realized a need to have more diversity and inclusion where our hiring practices have been concerned. This city, we're trying to make it mirror the population in terms of a minority population in the city of Bloomington. We'd like to have that mirrored also at the city of Peoria.
And how diverse is the city's workforce right now? What percentage are women, people of color?
The last time I looked, in terms of minorities, I think we're probably at about 15%. But in terms of women being represented in sort of the highest positions at the city, we do have a need for diversity there.
And as a reminder for our listeners, how many total employees, full-timers, does the city have?
We've got about 540 full-time employees.
So 15%, seeing that number grow, it would, you know, would be a pretty significant number.
Yes.
Quincy Cummings, the president of the Bloomington Normal NAACP, let's bring you into the conversation. How did the NAACP get involved with this effort?
It started from a conversation that was had with the former employee of the city. And from there, what we decided to do was to take a look at the data. And we decided to do it for both the town of Normal and for the city, but our concentration was on working with the city of Bloomington. So we decided to do a FOIA to take a look and see what representation there was of minorities in women within the city of Bloomington. And what we found, as Michael said, was that there was a need in both areas. And what we focused on mainly was on what you would call your professional, technical, and leadership positions. We found that there was more minority representation in the streets and refuse, that sort of thing. We found more minority representation in some of those jobs. But what we did not see was enough minority and female representation in the professional, technical, and leadership positions. So that was the impetus of our discussions with the city of Bloomington.
And Quincy, you've said that people of color have been reluctant to apply for job postings for the city.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, I just think there's a perception that they won't get interviewed. They won't even get an interview. And we've seen in the past where some have not, because what we did was we had a few, we kind of did our own sort of case study, and we had a few people actually apply for job openings, and none. I mean, we're talking about people who were well-qualified, had leadership experience, college degrees and that, and we had a few people apply, including my own sister who has two master's degrees, and didn't even get an interview, never got a call back. So, you know, so when you see things like that, and then when you hear other people in the community talk about, well, I don't want to apply for the city because I won't get an interview anyway, or, you know, it does show that there was a need. So when you see this happen, we felt the need to, you know, start to work closer with the city to not only socialize what the perception in the community was, but then also to strategize solutions, possible solutions for it.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm speaking with Quincy Cummings from the Bloomington Normal NAACP and Michael Hurt, Talent Acquisition and Development Manager for the City of Bloomington. Michael, this isn't just a City of Bloomington issue, right? I mean, do municipal governments around the country struggle with matching their workforce to the demographics of their communities?
Many do in smaller communities like Bloomington Normal. Not so much maybe in the major metropolitan areas, but in terms of the availability of some of these positions being in the current or the relevant labor pool around the City of Bloomington, it may be difficult to find female engineers or find minority accountants. So our efforts will be to expand our pool, expand our efforts in terms of reaching out further to bring in some of these individuals.
And Quincy, what's the risk if cities don't address this? I mean, other than simply being very unfair, what are the real bad things that can happen when a city's workforce is not representative?
So I think what happens is those qualified individuals bypass the community and they go where they feel like they're more comfortable. And So I think what it does is it sets a precedent, you know, and it, you know, I think if it's a problem, if there's a problem like this and it's not being actively or proactively addressed, it's telling people in the community that, you know, the city government just doesn't care. And what it tells people on the outside is, you know, maybe we should go to Chicago, maybe we should go to Indianapolis, maybe we should go to Des Moines or St. Louis, somewhere else where not only if there are more people who look like me, but I have I at least believe that I have a more fair shot. And I think that is the point of this initiative, is to start to do things a little bit differently. Not to say that recruitment efforts with the city had been lacking, but what we're trying to do here is find ways to build upon what the city is already doing and to attract that pool to come to the community, because Bloomington Normal is a wonderful community, but people have to feel that the opportunities are there for them to come. And then once they're there, what has to happen is that the right steps have to be put in place to not only attract those individuals, but to make them want to stay. If you see diversity issues that are not being addressed, especially, you know, within the city, what it does, it has an impact on young people too, because then the young people will leave and then they'll go to college or, you know, and they won't come back. So then we start to have that exodus away from our community, and it's all built on that thought that, well, there's nothing here for me. So that's another byproduct of having a DEG, or Diversity Enhancement Group, is to find a way to address that as well.
And Michael, you guys have been describing this initiative as focused on a professional, technical type of jobs. Maybe not so much public works, but even administrative jobs. Can you go one level deeper there and talk about the types of jobs, departments that, that maybe need this the most?
Sure. As I mentioned earlier, the finance department is one I would probably mention. There is a lack of diversity in terms of, and also it's just difficult to recruit sometimes. Minority accountants, individuals who would be well suited to positions in terms of budget managers, budget directors. We have a couple of director positions right now that need to be filled at that level. So we're expanding our efforts beyond Bloomington Normal to reach these individuals who have the expertise, who could bring a different perspective to the city. You mentioned earlier, what are the negative effects of not exercising diversity and inclusion. There's also an economic impact. People like to do business with individuals who sort of mirror themselves. And coming into contact with a homogenous group, it can be a deterrent to some people.
You know, when we think about recruitment of minorities, especially, we always, you know, talk about police and that sort of thing. And we do want to have more minority representation and female representation with our local police department and fire department. But, you know, I don't want, when we talk about recruitment and when we talk about diversity and hiring and that, when it comes to minorities, to be one-dimensional and to just say that, you know, we're, you know, we want to hire for police and that, you know, that's one dimensional. What we are covering here today essentially is that we want to see minority and female representation throughout city government, not just on the police department, not just in the fire department, not just in public works, but we want to see that in these professional and technical and management positions, because as we start to get more of that representation there, what I believe will happen is that it will become more inspirational to younger people, and they'll start to see, you know, a young lady will see a woman, you know, doing that job and think, you know what, maybe I can go into public administration and do that job. So, you know, it's not just to address a today issue, but it's also to address a tomorrow, what could potentially be a tomorrow issue as well.
And how are you defining diversity with this initiative? Are women wrapped into this too? I mean, we just saw the town of Normal had a milestone with its first woman becoming city manager there. Mm-hmm. Are women rolled into this initiative too?
We mean minorities. We mean females. We mean individuals with disabilities who are qualified to do these jobs. Diversity is a ever-expanding definition these days. So all of these individuals are our targets in terms of bringing them in as employees of the city.
My understanding is that you want to get community agencies involved in working with this initiative to find candidates for these positions. So describe how this would actually work in practice. Give me a scenario of how this initiative might look and work successfully.
Sure. We're looking at going beyond just posting a job, which is what we usually do, and then you hope that these candidates come in. Our efforts will be more affirmative in terms of going out to the individuals. Say there is a group meeting or monthly meeting of a Latina society, of an African-American group, of an Asian group. Our efforts would be to give them a call. Can we get 5 minutes on your monthly meeting? Make sure that our job announcements or job vacancies are sent to these individuals. By cooperating and collaborating with the advocacy groups in the community, they can help us find out where these people are. They'll have a better knowledge of it than we do. So they will help us concentrate our efforts and, you know, maybe come up with a broader pool of candidates.
And is there a goal? Is there somewhere you want to be at the end of 5 years, 10 years, in terms of seeing the numbers change within the city?
We have a goal right now to increase our diversity and inclusion efforts, increase our hiring by 20%, which is really ambitious, and to do that by 2022.
There are probably not a lot of young Black accountants coming out of college. I mean, for a lot of reasons, one of them that Black Americans are underrepresented on college campuses where accountants train. And now you're trying to recruit them to work for the city, but you're not the only one with diversity hiring initiatives. Other cities have them, so do private sector accounting firms. So how do you compete to land these candidates?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. All the things that you said, Ryan, we are in competition with other municipalities, with other companies that are expanding their diversity and inclusion efforts. I would say across the board, they do the same affirmative practices we do in terms of going to where these candidates are. And it will actually be a sales pitch that you make. We have to sell not only the city of Bloomington as an employer, but as a place to live. So those are the efforts that we're aware of, and our efforts are kind of focusing on young people. We have gone to the schools to do mock interviews, to sort of bring the kids up to speed, let them know about how to dress and prepare themselves for an interview. So those are the things we're doing to prepare our younger people.
That's Michael Hurt, Talent Acquisition and Development Manager for the City of Bloomington. He was joined via phone by Quincy Cummings from the Bloomington Normal NAACP. I'm Ryan Denham.
Community service agencies interested in partnering with the City of Bloomington in its new Diversity Enhancement Group initiative are encouraged to contact Michael Hurt with the city's HR department. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Brad Barker Honda, where the service experts have more than 200 years combined experience. Whether it's routine maintenance or a problem, Brad Barker's qualified technicians can help. More information available at bradbarkerhonda.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, get a tour of the new Habitat for Humanity ReStore and find out how the expanded facility could put more people in affordable housing. That report on the way during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A measure in play at the State House would train more nurses on how to collect DNA evidence after a sexual assault, often called rape kits. That report in a moment. First, Illinois Issues reporter Mary Cullen talks with Melissa Suto, who went through the rape kit process. The 23-year-old Chicago resident said she was raped on a college campus in Illinois, which she can't name because her legal case is still pending.
It was actually almost 2 years ago to this day that I got raped. I decided that I wasn't going to report it. It was my dad who came into my room and said, Melissa, let's go. We're reporting this.
What happened after you decided to report your rape?
So I walked into this hospital with my parents, who I could not look at. It made me sick to see because I felt so ashamed. So when the nurse came out, she was so sweet. This nurse was just the kindest woman I have ever met. So I went into a private room. I laid there for about 30 minutes, I would say, until the nurse came back. She had this kit. It was sealed. And so during a rape kit, it's just so invasive and intrusive. And it's the worst because you already feel so disgusted with other people touching you or looking at you after you've been raped that that's the last thing that you want to do. I seriously thought, I'm in a madhouse. Like, this is not my life. I'm in a nightmare. I'm going to wake up any second now. And I just closed my eyes and clenched my body. So when I was going through my story, you have to retell the story to the nurse so that he or she can write it down word for word. So it's another form of report. Any time that I had mentioned that he had touched me, she would try to grab a sample. So if he kissed me here, she took a swab and tried to get his DNA. And if he grabbed my hair, she brushed out my hair in hopes that something would fall out that had his DNA on it. So it was, I would say, 2.5 hours with the nurse going through step by step about what had occurred.
So you say you knew your attacker. You were hoping the evidence collected would be enough to convict him. How long did it take for you to hear back about the results from your rape kit?
That was 2 years ago in April, and I found out in the winter of 2017 that the DNA match. It took that long to get the results back.
With this whole issue of sexual assault and the culture behind it, do you think there's a way that we can push to solve this?
I'm one of the people that thinks that if you want change, you have to go out there and be the change you want to see. So I know it's not my place to tell other survivors how to respond to what might have been the worst moment of their life, but we all need to continue speaking up and telling people this isn't right. And I think we need to explain what rape really does, because a lot of people still believe that it was just unwanted sex. But rape has nothing to do with sex. It's all about power.
We're in a different place now than even a few years ago regarding talking about sexual assault. Where do you think we're at now?
So I think now people feel a lot more comfortable speaking up and saying that this happened to them. And with the Time's Up and the Me Too movement, people are realizing that that's not okay. It's not just, oh, that's just what happened, or you blamed it on the victim. I also am trying to do some research and trying to encourage other survivors to speak up. And I sent out a survey to some of my friends, and 83% out of 20 people said that they would feel comfortable now reporting in today's society versus 5 years ago.
Melissa Suto speaking with Illinois Issues reporter Mary Cullen about her experience undergoing rape kit testing. A measure that's passed the Illinois House aims to increase the number of nurses trained to evaluate rape victims. Supporters say the lack of sexual assault nurse examiners means many victims are treated poorly by the medical system. Mary Cullen also has that story.
Just over 4 years ago, Lindsay Ross says she was sexually assaulted. She went to a Chicago hospital and underwent tests for a rape kit. Ross says the nurse she saw was not specifically trained on working with victims of sexual assault, which was apparent based on her treatment.
I can't imagine you'd see a whole lot of survivors and still be rough and just generally mean, really.
Ross imagines her experience absolutely would have been different had she been seen by a sexual assault nurse examiner, referred to by those in the field as a SANE. At the hospital, Ross was bombarded with questions from staff and local authorities about her assault, and it only got more overwhelming when the nurse entered the picture. Ross says when she told the nurse that something hurt or was uncomfortable, the nurse told Ross she was being too sensitive.
It was a lot of that and just generally not gentle with my body and with my emotions.
Having a trained nurse present, a SANE, Ross believes would have improved an already painful experience. A proposed measure would increase the number of SANEs across the state within the next 4 years by more than 50%. It would also call for a maximum 90-minute wait period for victims who arrive at a treatment center, and it would provide specialized care for pediatric victims. Polly Poskin heads the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault. She supports the measure.
We think it's critical and incumbent upon hospitals to provide this expertise. We have trauma centers. We have the ability for cardiologists to respond to emergency departments in specialized cases, and rape is a specialized case.
As of now, sexual assault victims are treated the same, regardless of age. Dr. Channing Petrock with the Pediatric Resource Center in Peoria stresses the difference in need for care of a child versus an adult victim.
This bill will allow people to have their child transferred to someone who has competency or to go to a center where someone can do that exam under very child-friendly circumstances in a child-friendly setting with someone who has training.
It's estimated only a dozen Illinois nurses are trained to specifically help children who survive sexual abuse. SANE training involves 40 hours of instruction followed by clinical experience. Nurses can undergo specialized training, like in the case of pediatric assault, which takes additional time. Training nurses to complete these kits could add to the state's already existent backlog. According to a 2010 law, Illinois State Police Labs have 6 months to analyze kits, but only if sufficient staffing and resources are available. The Illinois Health and Hospital Association supports the objectives of the measure. But Senior Vice President of Government Relations, David Gross, says meeting staffing and training mandates is a concern.
About 80% of the nurses that start the classroom training don't finish the clinical training. So adding in the substantial emotional toll and burnout that SANEs experience, the turnover of SANEs can be even higher.
The measure would also burden some hospitals across the state with already tight budgets, says Gross. Despite testing nearly 2,500 forensic biology kits last year, there were still over 1,500 in the backlog, according to Illinois State Police. Lindsay Ross says she was told her case was being dropped 3 months after she underwent testing for a rape kit.
When they told me that they weren't pursuing it, I was angry, to say the very least. I fought to have them continue, but they wouldn't.
Ross says she has questions to whether evidence collected was even tested.
It's unacceptable not to test rape kits.
While the measure in play could mean more evidence is collected in the first place, work is underway by those who also want to tackle the growing backlog. I'm Mary Cullen.
The measure that would train more nurses to collect evidence from sexual abuse survivors passed the Illinois House and awaits a vote in the Senate. And Illinois Issues reporter Mary Cullen joins the GLT News staff next month. This is Sound Ideas on GLT. Thank you. Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A youth soccer organization is launching a capital campaign to pay for new fields. In January, the Illinois Fire Juniors signed a new lease on community fields owned by the Central Illinois Regional Airport. The three-year deal could be extended, but there has to be progress toward moving out for the airport to grant those extra years. WGLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds has more with Illinois Fire Juniors board member Jeremy Kelly, who says they don't want to waste that grace period.
We announced that we are starting a capital campaign. We've identified, why we haven't identified specific sites, we've talked to multiple landowners. We've identified what we need as far as a facility, what it would take, and we started kind of crunching the numbers, putting things together, and figuring out what would a future look like, or what would we need, whether it's our own, or whether it's a partnership with other, a Katie Kim, a Dave Stark, if cities get involved, if another group comes along and wants to do something. We're trying to figure out what would it take.
So talk about that number and specifically how it relates to the minimum that you think Illinois Fire Juniors needs.
Sure. Well, we know that if you look at our current facility, it's about 60 acres, and that's roughly 20 fields out there and some parking. And anybody that'll go to a tournament will tell you that the parking is a little cramped out there and it gets a little crazy. So we definitely know that we need something a little bit bigger. Obviously, we're looking at, are there options for just replace current fields to similar fields, but if we were putting something together, or if we were talking to a partner, we would come to them and say, hey, we are looking for something in the 100-acre sort of range, something with some bigger fields, something with some basic amenities like bathrooms, electricity, which we don't have at community fields now, maybe running water, maybe some better parking. So we would be looking at those things as a minimum. And when we put all those things together, started looking at land prices, not putting together the actual architectural plans of everything, but putting together what are the basics that it would take and what are the rough costs of those, we figured out to do something basic and get that 100-acre, not a Taj Mahal, but a basic facility. We did the numbers and it looked like we would need $2.25 million in order to do that initial kind of phase one, if you will, complex.
What percentage of that money would you hope to get from corporate donations, businesses, and then from groups and individuals? Have you thought that out?
Well, we haven't really targeted specifically we need this or that. I mean, I'd take $2.25 million from anywhere and everywhere. Obviously, we're looking primarily, there's some places we really feel that there's a fit with the business community. For example, if one of the biggest expenses is going to be growing grass, seeding, doing that, well, there's landscaping companies in town that wanted to do a sponsorship or partner with us, we'd be looking for that. If we're talking, somebody like Caterpillar comes in and says, hey, we'll donate some equipment and raise the fields or level the fields, that could certainly help. So there's opportunities where there's strategic partnerships like that, a Nike or any of the soccer community wants to come in and do some sponsorships. We're looking for those. But we're also looking for the local sponsorships. Scribbles has been a long time, very active sponsor. We'd be looking for local businesses like that, that are tied into our community, tied into the soccer scene, can help out. And then past that, we know that that's not going to get everything. We know that we're going to have to rely on individual fundraisers. That could be individual donors. That could be matching through an employer. That could be the simple campaign we're putting together, the ones you hear about, the eating out in town, or the different smaller fundraising events, I'll call them. And it could be bigger events where we've already had one trivia fundraiser as a for example. We're looking to do some bigger and bigger events, but we'll do whatever we need to in order to get to that number.
I'm Colleen Reynolds. You're listening to Sound Ideas, and I'm talking with Illinois Fire Juniors board member Jeremy Kelly about a $2.25 million capital campaign that was just announced this week. Have you been successful in finding a lead gift, which is something you typically look for in a capital campaign?
Yes, we actually announced this weekend at our tournament that we have a new naming rights sponsor for the next 3 years for our tournament. McLean County Orthopedics, TPC Training, and then Advocate Bromin are those three organizations came together and are doing a partnership with us, which is worth $75,000, which is a huge first step for us. It's a great leadoff, and we're very, very thankful for them and enjoying and looking forward to a great partnership over many years.
So they'll be donating that over 3 years?
Correct.
You mentioned at your tournament. Tournaments are considered money-making operations for the cities that host them. So sports tourism is something that the city councils have mentioned when they went out, particularly the town of Normal now has a feasibility study underway, and they mentioned the importance of sports tourism. Talk a little bit about that, because there are some people listening who don't care about soccer and don't have kids in soccer.
Sure. Well, in my opinion, it's one of these things that us as a community need to seriously look at to diversify our economic base. You look at other cities are doing this, and Rockford is an example we use all the time. I think our team's been up there 3 times this spring, and they have a tremendous facility up there, not too far away, and they had a tournament that got canceled for weather about a month ago, and they said that it was going to be $1.89 million of economic loss just from that weekend tournament. So we certainly know the numbers are there. Now, looking at the local scene, if you look at the numbers, last year we had the traffic counter come out. They put that at the entrance of our tournament, and on a super bad rainy weekend that was just terrible weather all weekend, we had 6,000 cars come in and out of our facility, and we had 2,000 people park across the street in the rain and walk across the street. If you compare the numbers from last year to this year, you're going to see a lot more people, a lot more cars, a lot more activity happening. We this year had 160 teams at our tournament, so if you figure about 10 to 15 kids per team, plus parents, grandparents, add on, that's a lot of visitors just in one weekend to Bloomington Normal.
So $2.25 million is significant. Have you done what they refer to as an environmental scan to see what kind of competition you have for raising money?
Well, we certainly are aware of, obviously, other organizations in town that are raising money, Boys and Girls Club, the Y, etc. We also know that there's competing interests everywhere, schools, nonprofits, etc. There's never enough money, right? But what I think makes us different is that we know that there's a massive economic impact piece to this. This, as you mentioned before, the sports tourism piece is something that comes to the table through our organization that some of the other organizations don't. And we have a very real need in that we've built the Illinois Fire Juniors. We've built this organization, 2,500 kids strong. And if we don't have fields, then that's at risk. And that's a huge service to our community. There's a lot of people involved, and it has impact beyond our community. So we know the combination of those factors should be enough to push this forward. And there's a lot of people that want to see this get done right.
Do you eventually predict that there will be private-public partnership in creation of a soccer complex?
I mean, I don't want to play the speculation game too much. Certainly, we've heard from some that might be an option out there. Could be a private option, and we're the first in line to be a tenant. Ultimately, if nothing happens, we're going to have to control our own destiny, raise the money, and find something ourselves. So there's different options or different paths. What we know is that on any of those paths, we're going to need the money in order to step up and either build it ourselves or be that first primary tenant for whatever group's running the facility.
There is another soccer organization, Millennium, that has worked essentially to create its own field and complex. Have you had any discussion with that organization about maybe teaming up on a single complex?
Certainly be open to anybody that wanted to talk on that. We've had some behind-the-scenes back-channel sort of communication, and they're a different club, so I can't really speak to their desire or where they're going. Personally, I feel that if there was one facility, our club, their club, other clubs could use that facility. I mean, that's good for the community. It doesn't have to be and never needed to be just an Illinois Fire Juniors sort of situation. So we'd embrace working with anybody, any partnership that wants to work with us, because ultimately we need fields and that impacts the community positively.
Does it seem as though there's a reluctance among Millennium and maybe some other organizations to partner, because with that, you do lose some control?
Well, I can't speak to their thinking or where they're at. I mean, we have heard a criticism before, for example, that said, you guys won't allow people out at community fields. And the reality is, you look at the lease, we're not able to in the current situation. So I think if you look to the future, if there was a facility, whether it's ours, whether it's somebody else's, I would hope that facility would be able to be inclusive and be able to have more people. You have lacrosse, as, for example, a tremendously fast-growing sport. They're looking for facilities. And if they wanted to partner together, we'd be all in. Let's do it. So we're not just doing this exclusive to soccer. We understand the greater good, the community impact, and the economic impact. And we want to bring everybody to the table if they're willing to come along with.
Lacrosse is now a sport at Illinois Wesleyan University. Do you see Illinois Wesleyan as a potential partner or any other schools?
Again, we're open to any conversations. We've had some informal, and I don't want to go into all the specifics, but we've talked to some of the different university partnerships out there. There's options. There's options. We're open to talking to anybody that wants to step up and be a part of this. Like I said before, we're inclusive. We're ready to go.
$2.25 million capital campaign being announced. What's your time frame for trying to raise that money?
Well, it's definitely something we need to do here in the next couple of years. By the end of this lease, we really need to have that money together so that we can show, okay, we have the money. It's time to start leveling some fields and growing some grass someplace. So definitely by the end of this lease is where we're looking at, but hopefully sooner. We're hoping to get some good momentum, start out strong, and hopefully we can get the shovels in the ground quicker than 2020.
Jeremy Kelly, is there someplace people can go to take a look at what you are asking for and proposing?
Sure. If anybody's interested in helping the cause, whether on an individual level or on a corporation or a business level, certainly go out to the Illinois Fire Juniors website or contact myself or any board member. All of our information's out there. We are a 501c3 organization, so it'd be a tax-deductible gift. And or if there's other ways that people want to partner outside of a monetary, we're open to that. We're just looking for everybody we can to come to the table and get us to that eventual landing spot of good quality community fields.
Jeremy Kelly from the Illinois Fire Juniors Board of Directors, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Colleen Reynolds.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
This Week in This American Life, LaDonna works security at an airport, a job she really loved, except for her supervisors, who did some pretty bad stuff. But LaDonna, she does not accept the world as it is. She reads a lot of businessy, self-help, lean-in kinds of books, and so she decides to put them to work to fix her situation. How that goes for her this week. Listen Saturday at noon on GLT, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Highway Chevrolet Buick GMC in El Paso, serving business owners and agricultural professionals across central Illinois, offering new and used cars and trucks and a certified GM service center. More information at highwaychevroletbuickgmc.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. After more than a year of construction, the Habitat for Humanity expanded ReStore on Bloomington's west side is ready to open. Habitat leaders say the expansion will make it easier to drop off donations and find affordable furniture and home improvement materials. It will also help them raise more money to build more houses in Bloomington Normal. GLT's Ryan Denham recently took a tour with Habitat's communication and procurement coordinator, Ashley Sang, ahead of their grand opening on June 2nd.
So this is sort of ReStore 2.0. We've been saying recently that it's the same location, just bigger and better. We did get rid of two buildings that were basically falling apart to begin with. So we got rid of those, and everything is a lot more visible from the road. Everything is a lot smoother for donors who come through, for customers who come through. It's a lot easier for our staff and volunteers to maneuver around and make it the easiest experience for everyone involved so that we can get the most items out the door and the most money to build Habitat homes.
By how much has the square footage of the building changed?
So before, we had about 13,000 square feet. In the process losing those buildings, we were operating with about 8,500 square feet for at least the last 9 months to a year. And we now have 20,000 square feet, so almost doubled in size. And we are just so, so excited to have it be better organized, look a lot sharper, and be able to get a lot more items in this space.
Okay, so Ashley, we are standing in a giant new space that, if you've ever been out to the ReStore, you know, the last several years, this wasn't here. This is not here. So what are we looking at here?
So we are looking at our expanded wing. This is about 12,000 square feet that we're currently standing in. And the expanded wing is going to be our more homeware decorative items. We're going to have our furniture, our media section, our lighting, all the decorative items that we didn't previously have space for. And we're going to have two registers instead of one, which will really, really help for especially those Saturday lines and things like that. And then in the previous building, the old wing, that's going to be all of our home improvement items. So all of our doors and windows that we hadn't been able to take this past year or so because we had limited space. And all of our building materials and tools, those sort of home improvement items will be in the older part. And they are connected. There are stairs and a ramp. And, we hope everyone will flow through both parts.
What's something you're really excited about?
Our donation drop-off dock. So it is now a drive-through. Instead of having to go to the very back corner of the parking lot, do a three-point turn, all of that stuff, we now, you zip in, you drop off your item, you drive through. If you want to stay and shop, you can park, you can shop, you can come in. If you don't, if you just want to drop off, drive off, you can now do that. We also have a new sold room area. So if you're not able to take your item with you right when you purchase it, we can store it for you in our sold room for 3 days, and you can just drive right up to that dock, pick it up, and again, you don't have all of that mess that sort of was in the previous parking lot.
Oh, yeah, so this is elevated, so if you had a truck or something, it'd be pretty easy.
Not only is it a drive-through, which is the biggest asset, it's also covered. So when it rains, when it snows, not only are our volunteers and our staff members protected, but our donors, it's a lot smoother for them as well.
Well, what about just the visibility of the Restore as it relates to Washington Street? I think if you've driven by here during construction, you can kind of, it looks totally different the way it's portrayed and just visible to Washington. Can you talk about what kind of the idea was there?
Yeah, visibility was one of the key factors that went into the design. So previously there was a building that was parallel to Washington that really blocked the entire parking lot and it made it look sort of closed off. So when we tore that down, we created a much bigger parking lot and it's so much more spacious looking and so much more visible, not only from Washington, but also from the trail. So when you pull up or drive by, you see, oh, this is a space that has something to offer, and I wonder what's inside.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm speaking with Ashley Sang, Communications and Procurement Coordinator at Habitat for Humanity, about the June 2nd grand opening of its expanded donation center and thrift store, called the Restore. During a recent tour, I asked Ashley what this expansion will mean for Habitat's ability to carry out its mission to build decent homes alongside families and volunteers in the community.
We are hoping to be able to cover over 100% of all of Habitat McLean County's administrative costs. So that means that for every dollar that someone donates to Habitat for Humanity, 100% of that dollar is going to build a home with a family in our community. So it's not going to be paying for printer paper. It's not going to be paying for people's salaries. It's going to be building homes. So not only do we hope to cover all of those administrative costs just with Restore revenue, we also hope to be able to start building more homes. So in the recent years, we've been building about 6 homes per year, and we are really excited to hopefully be aiming for 10 in the near future.
Habitat Restore made a conscious decision to stay physically where you were here on Bloomington's west side. If you haven't been out here before, it's just kind of off Washington Street on the west side of Bloomington. Why did you want to stay in this area?
We think West Bloomington has a lot to offer. We really see this expansion as an investment into West Bloomington. It's right on the Constitution Trail. We have awesome partners surrounding us. We have Boys and Girls Club just behind us, Heartland Head Start, Mid-Central, and Upper Limits directly next to us. And we also know that a lot of our homeowners that we build for live in West Bloomington, and a lot of our shoppers live in West Bloomington. And we wanted to be accessible, and we wanted to be a community fixture in the West Bloomington community.
It seems like so much of the revitalization that's going on the West Side is being led by the nonprofits here, be it the WBRP itself or even just the other day, the Boys and Girls Club announcing their new expansion building project over on Illinois Street in Erickson. And now you guys are about to open up here. Are you sensing that as well, that nonprofits are playing a pretty sizable role here in what's happening on the West Side?
Definitely. There's a great community culture here in West Bloomington, and it expands beyond just West Bloomington. We have a lot of partnerships with restaurants and companies and donors and shoppers all around Bloomington, Normal, and even the surrounding areas. So it's really nice to be able to have our hub here in West Bloomington, but really expand our reach far beyond that.
How does Habitat pay for a project like this? What are some of the, what's the funding mix, and how do you pull something of this scale off?
We actually have a loan with First Financial Bank. So they were able to offer us a lower interest loan, which really allowed us to launch this project. And we will be paying back that loan with revenue from our sales. So it's a self-propelling project. We will be gaining revenue from all of the donations that come through our door and all of the sales that come through our door so that we can repay that loan. And then ultimately the goal is to build more homes, support Habitat for Humanity further, and really use this investment as an investment.
The actual grand reopening celebration on Saturday, June 2nd. Again, what kind of things are folks going to see that day, and who should come out?
Everyone should come out. It's really for the community. It's to thank the community, and it's to welcome people who come here every day or once a week. It's also to invite people who have never made it all the way out here. Sometimes if they live way far south or way far east, maybe they've just never made it to the ReStore. They've donated, but they've never physically came to the store because we picked up their items. So it's really for all ages. There's going to be lots of kids' activities. Zoo Lady's going to be there, some balloon art. There's going to be live music. One of the things I'm most excited for is a flipped furniture auction with the International Interior Design Association. They have done this in the past, and all of the auction proceeds go to Habitat, which is great. And one of my favorite things about the ReStore is all the DIY furniture and other items that customers create and then share with us. So I'm really excited to see that auction.
That's Habitat for Humanity's Ashley Sang speaking with GLT's Ryan Denham about the $1 million expansion project at their ReStore. The grand opening, or rather grand reopening, is Saturday, June 2nd from 4 to 7 p.m. This is Sound Ideas. Cases of disease caused by mosquito, tick, and flea bites tripled in the U.S. between 2004 and 2016. The numbers come from the Centers for Disease Control. IPR's Rich Egger talks with a healthcare expert about the illnesses.
Tick-related diseases can cause mild to severe illnesses. In some cases, they can lead to death. Dr. Nirav Shah is director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. He says simple precautions can help people avoid tick bites.
This includes things like if you're out in the woods or on a trail, just walking in the center of the trail so that weeds and tall grass don't brush up against you. Using insect repellent, particularly insect and tick repellent that contains chemicals like DEET that are known to keep ticks away. And simple things like wearing long sleeves, long pants, tucking your pants into your socks, just anything that reduces the amount of skin that you've got open that a tick could latch onto. Those are really the safest and best ways to keep ticks away.
You know, you talk about being like out in a field or hiking or something. What about in your yard? Is there a chance of getting a tick bite in your own backyard?
It's a risk. It's a possibility. What we know is that ticks tend to hang out on tall blades of grass. And then when they sense that someone is coming near them, they're able to transfer over to somebody. But a lot of people's yards contain tall grass, and it can even occur in shorter grass, especially if you're walking out there with flip-flops or barefoot. It's entirely possible that a tick could jump even from a shorter blade of grass in the backyard onto somebody. Again, all the more reason to wear insect repellent now that we're in the summer months, and if possible, wear shoes and socks and not have and reduce the number of places that your body's exposed.
And some of the tick-related illnesses, diseases, can these last a lifetime, or do they have a limited time that they make you feel sick?
The main tick-related disease that we face in Illinois is Lyme disease. There are others, but Lyme disease is the one with the highest numbers. And if diagnosed early, Lyme disease is treatable with antibiotics. The signs and symptoms of Lyme disease are things like fevers, chills, aches and pains, and in particular with Lyme disease, a really characteristic bullseye rash. And it looks like just what it says. It looks like a bullseye. And if you've been out in the woods and you experience fevers, chills, aches and pains, and then you develop this bullseye rash, anywhere within 2 weeks of being outside in the woods or in tall grass, make sure you go see your doctor immediately.
And what does treatment involve?
treatment for Lyme disease involves a course of antibiotics, and it's an antibiotic that has worked well against Lyme disease for many, many years. And again, if diagnosed and treated early, Lyme disease is curable. It's not something that stays with someone for the entirety of their life. But the key there is making sure the diagnosis is made as early as possible and treatment is started as soon as possible. If those two things are done, Lyme disease is challenging. It can be serious, but that's the best way to minimize the risk of that serious disease.
If those two things are not done, what are the possible consequences?
Well, Lyme disease, like any disease that's left untreated, for a number of weeks and months can have significant consequences. It can cause really debilitating degrees of fatigue, long-term fevers, joint pains, muscle aches, a number of things that can carry onward if the disease is not treated promptly.
And then as far as mosquitoes, the most common mosquito-borne illness in Illinois is now West Nile virus. Is that a recent development, you know, within the last few years, that West Nile virus would be that most common mosquito-borne illness?
We've been contending with West Nile illness in Illinois and indeed in the United States now for over 15 years. But in recent years, what's really happened is two things. The first is that rates of other mosquito diseases have gone down somewhat, whereas rates of West Nile have started to tick upwards. Now, whether we're going to have a good or a bad West Nile season is really dependent on a lot of the weather patterns. And it's almost always too early to tell what a particular West Nile season is going to look like. But what we do know is that West Nile is a risk. We have a number of cases in Illinois every year, and including, unfortunately, occasionally some deaths associated with West Nile. But much as with tick-borne diseases, the best thing to do to protect yourself against West Nile is to minimize the risk of getting bitten by a mosquito in the first place. This includes things like, again, using insect repellent that contains DEET. What's good to protect you against ticks also protects you against mosquitoes. Trying to make sure you always wear long shirts, long sleeves, cover up with a hat when you're outside.
Dr. Nirav Shah is director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. He spoke with IPR's Rich Egger, and you heard it on Sound Ideas. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Ryan Denham, Colleen Reynolds, and Charlie Schlinker. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post your comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.